Okay, so obviously, oh, so I should mention that I'm now Attila, but I did this work while I was in Paris, working in the group of Claude Cantonucci with Yvan Castaing and Georges Lapnikov, and Thomas Bourdel, who's an experimentalist, in fact. So, but in the experiment of Christophe Salimon on fermions. So he's a natural choice as a collaborator. So, and you know, we won't go into funding agencies because this is a small group. So, okay. So what I'm going to talk about is how to get towards a weakly interacting BCS transition. And I want to differentiate that from the strongly interacting transition or this crossover transition. I'm not aiming at that. I'm aiming to get at low enough temperatures to get something that's classically BCS in an atomic Fermi gas. Okay. So obviously, to get there, you got to get things cold enough. So I'm going to talk about three issues in cooling that came up. And this is kind of a research story because each project followed the other was kind of a solution to the last one. And then finally, in the last one, I think we found something that would work. Okay. So at the time that I started this work, T over TF was limited to about 0.2, right? In order to get a BCS transition, you need something on the order of 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus 3, even if you have KFA fairly large, right? So to give the bottom line to start with, I'm going to talk about three cooling schemes. The first one will be out of equilibrium in the sense that I'll hold the bosons in a reservoir of a condensate at zero temperature, and then I'll bring fermions into contact with it and let it to equilibrate or evolve. And the important thing is I'm going to include the effects of loss. That turns out to be really, really important. Fermi C is very sensitive to loss. So that's the bottom line. Fermi C is very sensitive to loss. Okay, so the second thing that I'm going to talk about is this heat capacity issue. At the time that T over TF was going down only to 0.2, there was this argument that, you know, it was in sympathetic cooling, at least, it was due to the problem of the bosons having a lower heat capacity than the fermions as you progressively cooled them. Well, this turns out to be totally wrong, and I'll show you why that is. Okay, so... Yeah, right. So, and it basically has to do with the fact that one, you have evaporative cooling, and two, you have bosonic statistics, and both of those things are not taken into account in this idea of heat capacity as being limiting. Okay? And then the last thing I'll talk about is this idea which probably most of you have heard of, which I'm calling entropic cooling or adiabatic cooling, and it's the idea that entropy depends on temperature differently for fermions in comparison to bosons. So if you can change, for example, bosons into fermions, you get a lowering of temperature. Right? And that's exactly what you do in the BEC, the BCS crossover. Okay, so tuning a molecular BEC to, let's say, atomic Fermi gas. Turns out that this one actually solves the whole cooling problem. So that's the bottom line. And I don't know if we'll get to all three of these, but, you know, depends on the amount of questions that you guys ask. In fact, I don't have an introduction. That obviously comes from an earlier talk. I dropped the introduction because you all know about this stuff. So let's just dive into the first subject. I want to emphasize that this is out of equilibrium in comparison to the other two things that I'm going to present. And I'm basically going to study the competition between two processes. So the first process is that I have a boson in a reservoir. It interacts with the fermion. The fermion goes to some other momentum state, and the boson's excited. Okay, and then I remove the boson from the system. That's really key. That's the evaporation, right? So I move the excited boson from the system. And this will be in competition with loss. So I have a Fermi C, and a fermion gets knocked out, leaves a hole behind, and now the hole has to propagate upwards to the top of the Fermi C. And as that Fermi C relaxes, I end up at a higher temperature. Right? So this is a kind of a heating mechanism, and this is a cooling mechanism. Okay? And this was inspired by some work by Timmermans. He didn't really have the cooling. He only had the heating. He started T equals zero and started knocking fermions out and saw how long it took for things to heat up. Okay? And I'm just going to do it in a uniform system. I'll do it in a pretty simple model because I just want to get at the competition between these two mechanisms. And the basic questions I'm going to ask are about thermal equilibrium and what happens to the number distribution. So the model is as simple as I could get while still retaining the main features. I have a perfect reservoir, which means the reservoir has no influence on the system other than to cool it, right? So it's an ideal gas. It's held at T equals zero. The number of particles in the reservoir that is not changing, and the all the excited bosons are just taken out. And the next thing is that I'm going to assume that I have no interactions between fermions.
How do you get this, keep constant number of particles and get all the excited bosons?
Oh, because if NB is, you know, extremely large, then NB minus 1 is about equal to NB. So I'm making this approximation.
So it's not a constant.
Ah, it's a constant within the approximation that I'm making. But it's of course, it's not constant. It's also not true that it's at T equals 0. I mean, none of that stuff is true. So, but what's actually key in my, what's actually key in, let's see. Where will that come in now? Oh, the density of bosons is being held constant. Right. Right, actually it's density because it's in a box. And so I'm assuming the density is not decreasing on the time scale of the experiment by any significant fraction. Okay? So the next thing is that I have just one spin state of fermions, okay, just to start with for this study. So I don't have any interaction between fermions. And I don't have any interaction between bosons, right? Because then I do Bose gas. And then I have a contact potential, you know, between them. And then all the other usual theoretical stuff. I mean, I have a, you know, 3D box of periodic boundary conditions. I mean, a 3 torus, what the heck is that? But, you know, it works fine. And then this is a very important feature. Because I have evaporation, I have a time scale for that evaporation. Okay, so I'm going to introduce evaporation discrete steps of duration TE. So TE is very important. It's going to come in all the time. And 1 over T is about equal evaporation rate. Okay, and the last thing is that for loss, I'm just going to model loss by a constant loss rate. So that's like, for example, background gas in the vacuum that knocks fermions out.
Of what, the bosons?
Sorry?
Is that the evaporation of the bosons that you're talking about?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Right. The fermions are not being evaporated. So the idea here is that one is evaporating only the bosons in order to keep them at zero temperature.
These are the excited ones that are getting evaporated?
That's right. Yeah, exactly. And this constant fermion loss rate is like, you know, like if you had a, I mean, it's actually a big part of what goes on in experiments. You have background gas in the vacuum every once in a while, and these are very highly energetic particles, right, because they're not cooled. So they knock fermions out of the fermion sieve every once in a while. And that's just completely random as to you know, what momentum state they knock out. Okay, so the Hamiltonian is just a kind of standard one that you all know and love. And here, B is the boson, and C is the fermionic creation operator. And then you see I just have a contact interaction, and everything else is standard. The only thing I want to mention is that I really am staying, you know, in the regime of sums, not integrals. Okay, that's an important point. And then the only thing that's a little strange is that rather than having a constant contact interaction, I branch it on and off. The reason I branch it on and off is because somewhere I have to make a measurement. Okay, and it turns out that if you want to develop Boltzmann equations out of a system like this, that you have something sort of analogous to Fermi's golden rule. Okay, and so in Fermi's golden rule, actually what you do is you do something like this, right? So you have a time interval, and the sharp edges are what give you that, you know, that when you do the Fourier transform of this thing, give you, you know, this octopus, or what do you want to call it, there's a name for it in French. I know it's called sine x over x, you know, this function. So we want to get rid of these sharp edges, so we just sort of smooth them out. And this time interval is just 1 over the evaporation rate. Okay? So just to clarify that I'm going to branch the interactions on and off, and rather than doing it like people do in Fermi's golden rule with the square function, I'm just going to do it with something a little smoother. The reason is that otherwise I get non-adiabatic effects. I get divergences and horrible things, as anyone who's worked with Boltzmann equations would know. Okay, and the other thing is I'm going to do this with perturbation theory. So these are both...
Why is there a time dependence to the interaction? Why can't you just turn it on at, say, time t equals 0 and just start from there?
Right, if you did that, then it would never happen that the, for example, all the fermions would decohere from any given boson. So if I wanted to do a kind of a mean field theory, if I want to do a simple Boltzmann equation, I would be unable to do that, right? Because the entire fermionic wave function would always be coherent, right? I couldn't come down to sums over all the different fermions. So. No one agrees with this? So. Let me show you what I'm going to make out of it. So this is the equation that I'll derive out of with perturbation theory. So let's look at this equation and talk about it. So do you think that you can do this equation without having a time scale in it?
If I just have a constant interaction,
right,
I'll do golden rule boron.
No. The constant, the golden rule is what happens for the golden rule is that you to put in the delta function for the golden rule. What you're saying? What I have to do is I have to take this time all the way out to infinity,
okay,
which is just what you're saying.
Wait,
before we go on, I want to answer your question. Okay? Okay. So in terms of relation to golden rule, I'll tell you. Of course, that's what I first did, and it turns out to give absolutely the wrong answer. So if I take these limits of time for the interaction to infinity, right? That makes this function become a delta function for the golden rule, right? This is g of omega. Okay, if this becomes a delta function, then unless I assume a continuum, I can't have anything happen at all. I don't see the structure of the trap, et cetera.
Can I just ask you my question, which is very simple? Suppose
sure.
I do just bosons, just one single component bosons, and I'm going to derive kinetic equation from the golden rule. The standard quantum kinetic equation.
Yes.
I have a constant and time as scheduled thing. Do I need any time dependence, or will I fail to write collision term in the kinetic equation in this case, just for both?
If I turn this sum into an integral, I can take this limit of this delta function.
So
okay?
Everything is okay.
But only if I take the sum to an integral. So I have to get out of the discrete regime. In other words, it's okay in the thermodynamic limit, but it's not okay if you're not in the thermodynamic limit.
I guess the model he has is that he has this system of evolve over time, but this time is chunking into pieces. Within each of these pieces, he does evaporation discretely.
Right.
So that means this time-dependent coupling, although it looks time-dependent, but within each of this interval, before he does the evaporative cooling, looks like effectively a constant, I guess. That's what.
Yeah, go ahead, Tony, you want to ask me about this? This also took us some time to understand. I mean, it's not an obvious point, so I appreciate the questions. Go ahead.
Well, this must surely reflect the fact that within a finite world, the energy levels are discrete, and therefore,
yes.
Strictly speaking, you will never get energy matching for any particular condition.
That's right.
However, if in fact some of the processes are evaporative, then by definition, the particles fly off into an untracked region, right? So there, the energy spectrum should be almost continuous.
When I do the Fourier transform of that, I mean, but you're talking about where they go to, but remember that there's still the discrete energy levels of the fermions. The fermions aren't flying out.
No, true. But as long as
right.
There's one particle which has a continuous spectrum of energy, this problem with the discreteness should be resolved, I would think.
Yes, if I had only a continuum problem, but I don't, right? I mean, I have a discrete problem.
If you neglect evaporation for a while and just consider the collisions within the track, then
yeah.
It seems to be sure to take the discreteness seriously.
That's right.
And
that's what I'm doing.
Yes, but I mean, shouldn't you take it as it were much more physically seriously than you are? I mean, you're introducing this device to...
So you're basically saying I'm more right than I think. Okay. Well, I thank you. But what I guess I didn't say very well is that it is a device in the sense that there's no reason why this has to be a sine squared, right? I mean that's my own choice. I can make it a square function or sine squared, but I need a time scale. If I don't have a time scale, I can't deal with a discrete system. And that time scale is, let me finish. The time scale is a natural thing in experiments. It's 1/1 the evaporation rate. I mean you have to have the evaporation rate in there somewhere. That's where it comes in. So please.
The trick that you use to put some language in your system somehow.
Some what?
Some language.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Some language.
Yes.
Language.
Yeah.
Now I can refer over my question. Now
go
I
ahead.
Am starting to understand. So your system is essentially discrete.
Yeah.
And then I need to compare the kinetic time with interlevel separation.
Yes.
Because normally you solve the problem.
Exactly.
If I see that if my kinetic inverse kinetic time it just becomes smaller than interlevel separation.
Right.
Just kinetics will be suppressed.
That's right.
Basically, your time dependence is just a tool. Just to introduce the kinetics.
But this is very good is, in fact, my next transparency, which is the meaning of this equation. Okay. So, but before I get to it, let me show you the equation itself.
Can you go back to the previous? I just have simple questions.
Mm-hmm.
So the interaction between bosons and fermions are time dependent in this model. So that is that. I mean, I guess I'm just confused. So if I have a collection of boson and fermions, and then the evaporation process, I just take away the bosons. But why would it why should it be modeled as a time-dependent interaction between bosons and fermions? I guess I.
Okay, so first question is at what rates do you take out the bosons,
right.
And how do you get that rate into the problem, right? Okay.
Well, couldn't you introduce into the Hamiltonian non-Hermitian term that just the bosons above a certain energy?
That would be another possibility.
At a certain rate, evaporation rate.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to get the bosons up there by interaction by the fermions.
Right.
So if you put that kind of a term into the Hamiltonian, then you just turn everything on to time table zero, and it takes care of itself. Everything is time independent then.
Mm-hmm.
But you just lose these bosons as they get up to high energies.
It's like reasonable iron.
Right. It's another possible way to do it. I agree.
But the way Eric has suggested,
and
you suggested that would it be purely dissipative? mean, I worry about here, how do you know it's always dissipated? Because you may be pumping energy into the system, yes.
With that form of interaction?
Yeah, with this, you may be actually pumping.
Yes.
You see, there was
this one you think that I'm pumping in?
Huh? Yeah, it may. You see, I don't know.
Self-obvious that it will just relax.
I'm pumping energy into the system. Look, the bosons and the fermions are interacting, and I have to somehow, if I'm going to get to a Boltzmann equation, I have to somehow end up with something that, I have to somehow get this mean occupation number, right?
These are very dissipative equations, yes.
There's only dissipation as a loss I put in by hand. Otherwise, there's no loss. There's no dissipation at all. Sorry? Yeah.
Tell us, please. People give a lot of work on elaborating cooling over thermal gaps in the case of bosons.
Right.
A lot of kinetic theories have been constructed. They nicely coincide with experiments and so on and so forth. And the discrete structure of trap levels, and that's what the issue is here.
Yeah.
Was never important. It was just continuous with delta functions, ordinary equations. You only
right.
Well, what makes the difference here?
Okay, so why is that?
Compare what you do with evaporative cooling, with ordinary theory of evaporation, which people were doing for a number of years.
Right.
What is so special here?
Let me think about it. What is so special here? Well, what's so special here is that when I started the problem, I am going to take a continuum limit at some point just for fun. You'll find out the results are different. So when I started out the problem, I wanted to be as general as I could and leave the discreteness in. And then if I want to go to a thermodynamic limit, I can, but at least I have the option of not doing so. So it's not a great answer to your question, but I want to say that, for example, that the basic physical quantity I'm after, which is what is the lowest temperature you can get to, turns out to be different depending on whether you're in a discrete regime, a non-discrete regime, if you use a quantum Boltzmann master equation or just a quantum Boltzmann equation. These things really do matter. Huh?
We shouldn't turn the question around and ask, why do the boson calculations work as well as they do?
Yeah, yeah. So, in this case, it doesn't work. And, why one thing to think about is that... it depends if for example, you have the intershell versus intershell regime, in this work by Brun, about the BCS transition temperature, right? So you can either have pairing within a harmonic oscillator shell or between harmonic oscillator shells. And this is a very important difference. And you get a totally different dependence of the critical temperature on the Fermi temperature for a BCS transition. So in that case, for example, discreteness makes a big difference. It's always a strong approximation to go to integrals.
This discreteness is important for small traps, and that's what Gisbrough was considering, drawing an analogy with nuclear fuel.
Right.
Usually, if you do evaporative cooling with a thermal gas, you just introduce a trapping potential, and you nicely proceed. Moreover, what is actually important there, for example, in cylindrical traps, for regular chemicals, or for chemical potential, get the stochastic motion of probability of quasi-bar. And then all this issue of discrete structure of threat levels is out, which makes life completely different. You should apply the Dyson statistics and so on. Which makes the problem very different.
Discrete energy level shows up everywhere. But it's not a problem because it involves a summation. All you want is a lowest energy statistics.
It's the matter of ratios. As I was saying, you need to compare kinetic time with interlevel level separation. And normally, as Zoro was saying, see that this kinetic time just makes the discrete, renders the discreteness absolutely irrelevant. Because it's very short as compared to the discreteness.
Right. Right.
I saw this when I was analyzing kinetics, for example, BC formation. It can become relevant only at very low energy level.
I'd like to go on because
clearly the correct way is to introduce a density matrix. You're doing it artificially in some way. Presumably it works out okay. But if you put in this periodic potential, what you're going to get out is flow kinetic states for a solution of the Hamiltonian equation. They're not going to look like a dissipating thing. You have to do it with a density matrix, but you somehow put in an approximation somewhere to get out the dissipation. Hopefully, you get this right.
Okay. I do introduce a density matrix, but that's in a part I wasn't going to talk about today. But I could go over it if that's what you guys prefer. I want to move on now because this actually is the answer to what Bode said. So I guess before writing the quantum Boltzmann equation up, I should have written understanding the quantum Boltzmann equation. The question is you know, what is the meaning of continuous versus discrete? And this is exactly what Bode said. If I take the Fourier transform of my particular time-dependent interaction that I chose, right, then I get something which has, I mean, these tails have little wiggles, but they're so small you can't even see them on this scale, okay? And there's a width to this function, right? And that's a width in energy space, and this omega is a condition on the conservation of energy. So within this window, right, I do not require conservation of energy. Okay, so I can have different, it's sort of like an uncertainty principle. Okay, so the important thing is whether or not I have, if I now take this and I line it up on a plot of the trap, in this case a box, right, I have some spectra spacing, and I have to ask, does this coherence window, this is like energy, okay, does this coherence window cover very many levels, huh? Or does it cover only one level? Huh? If it covers only one level, or only a couple of levels, I'm somehow in the relatively discrete regime. If it covers very, very many levels, I'm in a kind of continuum regime. Okay? If I'm in the continuum regime, then I can take I can change this sum for an integral, and then I can take yet another step, which is to take this time, this evaporation time, and remove it from the problem and make this a continuous time equation rather than discrete time equation. Okay, so there's going to be two requirements that will come into this Boltzmann equation, and the first is the width of this I'm calling a coherence window. So this coherence window function, and that's basically related to TF over T. Okay, and then another, how can I say it? I want to say that okay, to clarify that point, if I have a Fermi distribution, right? Let's make it an energy again. Okay, I can only cool to the minimum width of this coherence window, right? Because once I get any bit below this, then I just have a sort of uncertainty and things just bounce around inside of this width. Okay, so that's this limitation. So in terms of how I choose this time parameter, which relates to this time-dependent interaction, which relates to the evaporation rate, it's got to be greater than TF over T, and it's got to be much, much less than TF over T times 1 over the collision rate, and that's due to the limits of perturbation theory. Okay, so this is somehow fundamental about the whole model, and this is somehow related to the fact that I use perturbation theory, the quantum Boltzmann equation.
You're going too fast. What's the meaning by width?
Oh. So I take the Fourier transform of that time-dependent interaction.
Just extend.
Yeah.
I don't understand what the first inequality means. The second requirement.
So this is this, right? A temperature comes out of the width of the mean occupation number distribution.
Yeah.
Right? And so now I have a function which is controlling how the fermions can move around, how they can jump around.
Yeah.
Right? So if this width becomes much, much less than the width of this function which controls the movement of fermions in this space, right, then nothing more happens. It just keeps moving around in this window. I can't cool anymore.
Oh, I see. You want the width to be wider than the...
No.
You want the
narrower.
Narrower.
Smaller.
What is the difference between EF and TF?
Yeah.
KB.
EF and TF.
KB.
No.
I'm sorry, I did not stay with annotation of the book. I apologize. Yes, Eugene.
I mean, physically, that what you're doing is removing high energy atoms, and that has to be put into the calculation in some way. And so when you put that in, think about that, that's going to give these high energy states a lifetime, lifetime, broaden those levels, so they're not no longer discrete. And so that relaxes your energy conservation condition, right? So you can just do perturbation theory with that sort of implicitly in there. Your delta function, your energy conserving delta function, just is broadened by the width of that level.
That's
so everything goes through with that kind of formulation.
But that's what I've done, right?
Well, I don't know. No, you put this time-dependent interaction in, which is kind of strange to me.
Huh.
What's really physically there is the fact that you're removing these high-energy atoms, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's giving the breadth, the width, everything. And that's the width that's important. That's the evaporation time. Or so everything is quite natural if you look at it that way,
okay.
I think.
Kinetics itself provides some level, even if there is no evaporation, even if the system is all conserved.
That's true.
You have collisions.
That's true. Yeah.
Right, but he's worried about the region where this broadening apparently is not important, but then what Eugene said is right. I mean, there is another source of broadening anyway.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
It may have amount to the same thing.
Okay, I think this is a great point, but I don't think I can answer it off the top of my head now. I think it's a good question, and I'll think about it, Eugene.
But your condition that you wrote down can never be satisfied at lower and lower temperatures.
That's right. So there's a limiting temperature, which is determined by the evaporation rate. That's right. Actually, we're going to find out that it's not determined only by the evaporation rate. It's also determined by the loss. So that's the feature I want to mention now. So out of that Hamiltonian, which I'd written down, I use basically Wick's theorem, okay, which is a strong assumption, and then I get out these two terms, and I'm going to add in a loss term by hand. So to clarify everything in this equation, should I need to go over the Korn-Boltzmann equation? You guys all know it, maybe, huh? Okay. Well, let me just say that I've added in a loss term, and here I have fermions going in at any particular level and fermions going out of any particular level, and here's this kind of energy width. This is an energy conservation condition, if you like, and here is this coherence window. Okay? And you see that there's a density of bosons in here, and I'm holding NB to be approximately equal to be constant, Dmitry. So that's where it's it comes in. Okay. So let's move on. Fine. So now I run this, do some numerics on this equation. Okay. So the first, and I apologize for all these little tiny axes, but I tried to give you large labels here so you could see it. So the first thing to notice is that I can play around with this evaporation time parameter. Okay. And that there is kind of an optimum evaporation time in order to get a minimal temperature. And here I choose different loss rates. I want to clarify that this ratio will come in throughout. This is the loss rate, that's the collision rate, and those are the two processes that I was considering in the beginning. Okay? Competition. And KBT over mu is like T over TF, right? So you see the kind of minimum temperature I'm getting down to is like on the order of 0.2. And then what I'm doing here between A and C is I'm making the loss rate much less. Okay, and this is actually experiments are somewhere close to this regime, maybe a little bit less, but they're not really there usually in sympathetic cooling problems. okay, and so you see that there's an optimum, and then this solid curve is the thermodynamic limit, which is that delta function kind of assumption, or almost delta function kind of assumption, okay? It's where I take the sums into the integrals, yeah? Okay, so this first thing I want to show you is that you really do get a different result in terms of the minimum temperature that you get to. Yes?
For smaller loss, you get more cooling. Less
than? For smaller loss, you get a lower temperature. This minimum temperature is like. Say it again.
That's on the same time scale, maybe nothing.
No. Is the minimum temperature on the same time scale? Yeah. Well, the minimum temperature is approximately set by the one over the collision time is about the time scale to get to whatever the minimum temperature is, and then there's slow heating on the time scale of one over the loss rate.
Loss was zero.
So I had this in another talk, but I guess you guys are really excited about this, so I'll probably be only presenting this topic. So that's good. So for example, if I wanted to do something like T over mu, I'll leave out the KB, and then as a function of time, okay, then I would see something very fast, and then some kind of slow heating, okay, and this first regime is like one over the collision rate. And this, later heating regime is like one over the evaporation rate. Sorry, loss rate. So there's kind of fast cooling, and then there's a slow effective loss. Okay, and so the question is, what is this minimum? And that's what I'm plotting here, and how that depends on the evaporation rate. Okay. Right. Oh, and so the other lines are for different numbers of atoms. Like I did 100 atoms or 1,000 atoms or whatever. So. That also affects this, of course. okay, so another thing is this point that Boris was talking about, and this is this idea that depending on I should have changed my screen resolution. I'm sorry, this is slightly cut off. This is actually the mean occupation number as a function of k, and the sub n is the little time step. So the idea is that I start with the open circles and I end up with the closed circles. And if T is small, that is to say that the evaporation rate is fairly large, then I really am in the thermodynamic limit. But the evaporation rate is too slow, then I somehow get in this discrete regime. Okay? And you can see that because I don't get an isotropic number distribution. And what that means is that I'm sort of feeling the corners of the box, if you will. I'm not, right. I'm feeling the shape of the trap.
How many iterations actually do you do here?
Here, I don't remember how many iterations, maybe 1,000, 10,000, something like that. I mean, it depends on the kind of underlying step that I take, right? So you're asking iterations of the code, or what are you asking about?
Iteration of this.
Of TE?
Evaporation.
I don't know in this particular plot, because I did this work like a year and a half ago, but typical number of iterations, I mean, for fast evaporation, 1,000 is fine. For slower, it has to be 10,000, you know, something like that. How many time steps?
Able to follow all those. But suppose I do not have loss rate. I don't have a perfect vacuum. And so what would be the lowest temperature attainable by this process?
Zero.
You can really... But
it would take infinite time.
Infinite source of a boson, basically.
It would take infinite time.
Okay.
It's not an infinite source of bosons. That's key. It's not an infinite source of bosons. The key is that I have no losses. The Fermi C is so totally sensitive to loss that if I have even a tiny fraction of losses, I mean, that, if you saw on that previous slide, this is 10 to the minus fourth. I mean, this is very small loss rate.
I would have thought that I would still need to equilibrate the Fermi surface. Once I evaporate, the Fermi surface is not sharp. So there's an intrinsic time due to the boson fermion interaction that take you to the perfectly sharp Fermi surface.
Actually, there is no perfectly sharp Fermi surface, which is another thing I want to show you about this model. Huh?
Even without loss rate, I would like to understand one simple situation first. Suppose I have no loss rate, how good can I do if I decide I cannot do well?
Well, in infinite time, you would get to a perfectly sharp Fermi surface. That's correct. Huh?
But that requires infinitely many
steps. So.
Let's get some more meaningful questions about what.
Okay.
Suppose I evaporate with a certain rate. So how then that give me a time scale, and how fast that I within the time scale that I could reach to as sharp a Fermi surface as possible. Once I have, if you give me an evaporation rate, then there it defines time scale presumably.
It's a time scale, but I guess TF over T must come into it, right? So depending on the temperature I'm aiming at, but
so
I don't know in what power.
To get to that, because the time takes for these, infinitely many rounds also becomes infinity, because when you do it repeatedly, the temperature becomes lower, then every time scale also becomes longer, yes? Because collision time also becomes longer. You see, phenomenologically, this boson fermion synthetic cooling has been studied by many people before. I remember that in the fermionic case, when you do evaporative cooling, normally you set the cut at 1/3 to 1/10 of the temperature. Yes, so that means you cut it once, to 1/3 of your temperature, throw away all of this, then you do it once. I mean, if you want to do it 100 times, 3 to the power of 100 over 1,
wait a minute. Now, we're talking about a totally different model. So you're talking about a model in which you do, if you throw in interactions, you need the mean field. If you don't, at least you have a continuum approximation, and then you make cuts, and then you let it equilibrate. This is an out-of-equilibrium system. I'm holding the bosons at T equal to zero. It's totally different from those studies. I know the ones you're talking about. For example, the first studies done with just bosons were like Walraven, for example, did some very good studies. And I read all this. It's quite different. And actually, the next thing that I was going to present, if I had time, I will do something like that, but not in this study. This is a kinetic system. I don't make any assumptions about equilibrium.
Let me try another question.
Okay.
So the bottom line would be that should the metal use this at all? Is it good at all? No matter how you do it, it's no good, basically. So what is the answer?
So are you saying that you don't want me to present the next two transparencies? Because the answer will come at the end, but I can tell you now if you prefer.
Oh, I see.
I was going to lead up to it.
I see.
Because I thought that would be exciting. But
it's a problem. You need to decide.
I'm fine with how things are going. It's okay with me. I like the questions. It's useful. I mean, I'm learning things. So another point is about the number distribution and how it evolves. And I want to make the comment that even if I start with an equilibrium number distribution, which is like, for example, this one, it will evolve into something non-equilibrium. For example, here, in the case of a lithium-lithium mixture, what happens, by the way, the important thing here is the ratio of the masses, yeah? So what happens is that I get something, it's not really a Fermi distribution. For example, the tail is far too cut off. If I was going to try to do a Fermi fit to this, it would come in lower here and go out further here. And if I take the case where the messes are even quite different, like a lithium-sodium mixture, like in Wolfgang-Kettele's experiments, then I'll find that I even develop this hole around small momenta. Okay. So the key is that you do get to a kind of a quasi-static equilibrium, but it's not a thermal equilibrium. Okay. Okay. So that's one thing that comes out of this kinetic theory. Fine. So here's what Jason's asking. So does it help? Does this system work? Or what kind of temperatures do you get to? Well, what is the minimum maximum degeneracy or minimum T over TF that I get to as a function of the loss rate of the collision rate? Right? And you see that you can get down to 10 to the minus 2, which is what you need, something like this for BCS, right? But you've got to get this ratio of loss rate to collision rate to be quite small. Okay, so that's the bottom line, if you like, that you should lower your loss rate in respect to the collision rate. And why are losses so important? I mean, that's simply because for fermions, okay, so these are bosons, and all my bosons are in the bottom level, right? And for fermions, they're... You know, so if I take a boson out of here, it doesn't change this distribution, right? But if I take a fermion out of here, I have a big hole that has to propagate up towards the surface, and I have this whole relaxation process. So the point is that fermions are extremely sensitive to loss, and that these experiments should be either raising the collision rate or lowering the loss rate in order to get to lower temperatures. Okay, so that was one of the results of this study. you actually get a power law in the dependence of this minimum temperature on the ratio of loss to collisions, and the exponent for the power law is 0.44. And this I get numerically. Now, if I was to go ahead and do an analytical model in which I did assumed a fermion size, I put it all in the, so that would be this kind of assumption like you were talking about, Lee, huh? Then I would find a power law of 1/3. Okay, so I do get a different power law by making that assumption. So that says that those are really fundamentally different things. Okay? And then if I want to go to do a quantum Boltzmann master equation, which is very important because it includes another process, which I'll mention in just a moment, then I get a power law of 0.51, again numerically. And I'm not going to show you all the work on this, but this is a whole other half of this project. Okay? And the reason that I mention this is because in the quantum Boltzmann master equation, I include the process of a fermion scattering off of a boson. Right, the boson is excited from the reservoir. Now a second fermion scatters off of that boson. The boson goes back into the reservoir. Now it's a stimulated process. It's a second-order stimulated process of effective interactions between fermions, and that turns out to be extremely important. Okay, and that was left out of this initial Boltzmann equation approach. Okay, so that's what I want to tell you about that project. How am I on time, Jason?
You have used up 45 minutes.
Since the time that we arrived here?
No, since the time you started.
Since the time that I started?
That's why I had to ask you.
Wow, okay. Well, should I skip the rest and just go to the conclusion? It's up to you. I have this...
I think the important thing is from your point of view, what is the most effective way to get to...
To get to low temperatures.
With BCS. I think with this question, we're much more efficient. You don't need to go through any of this and just say, what do you think the best way, and then you start from there, and then why you think that...
Oh, yeah. Okay, so...
Sorry?
Right.
So that's why I would like to have it in 1 hour so that I could go to the next hour as well.
Okay, so, so I did another study in which I showed that you should actually lower the heat capacity to bosons with respect to fermions. It's the opposite of what you normally think. And I guess I won't show you the details of that, but that's another thing for experimentalists to do. Okay?
Can I try? From your viewpoint,
I will get to that.
Which one is the best?
I will get to that, but I want to mention this briefly. So I understood what you wanted. So, okay. So in this, I'm mentioning this study because not everyone will use the method that I'm going to suggest at the end. Right? There are still people doing just sympathetic cooling. So I want to tell them how to improve their sympathetic cooling, which was the first goal of all the studies that I undertook. Okay. So one thing was to lower the loss rate, and a second thing is to get the heat capacity of the bosons low, and to make sure that they're both condensed. And that's what comes out of this study, which I'm now going to skip by. Okay. And the last thing that I'm going to mention is this work that I did with Jora, and this turns out to be the most promising because you can do it in a single step. You don't have to do all this cooling steps. And there aren't really any hefty assumptions in here. I mean, this is a very straightforward thermodynamical study. And so here's the usual BCS temperature. And basically, the idea is that if you start with bosons and change them into fermions in some way, then if you do it while holding entropy constant, that is to say adiabatically, you get a temperature advantage, right? The temperature decreases in the power cube. So that turns out to be enough to get BCS to answer your question, Jason. And I'll show you the numbers for this. But this was the final solution to this whole long study that I did through several papers. So the first thing you have to do is you have to figure out what the entropies are, and you got to put interactions in because these are really interacting systems. So I just say all the things that went into it. Here's the result. You get some kind of ideal entropy with the correction in KFA for fermions. And for bosons, you get like an ideal entropy with a correction in mu over KBT. And for fermions, this term is just a couple of, like, 5%. It's not very important. But for bosons, both of these terms are extremely important. In other words, the interactions in bosons are vital in terms of getting the entropy right. Okay? So you have to set these equal and figure out what the final temperature is. Okay? So given an initial molecular BEC, by the way, this work was done before molecular BECs came out, so it was a little hopeful. We got lucky. So given a molecular BEC, now what is the final temperature when I change the molecules into their constituent fermions? Okay, so I give you some numbers. So for example, if I started with initial temperature of TBC over 2, which is a typical experiment, I already get down to the best lowest temperature that any experiment has gotten so far, 5 times 10 to the minus 2. If I start with TBC over 4, right, I get down to a temperature of 5 times 10 to the minus 3. So that's really well into the weakly interacting BCS regime. So this is done in some experiments, this kind of temperature. So the point is that it does work. I'll show you a plot. I made an assumption here that mu is about equal to KBT. You might ask what happens when the chemical potential is a little different from KBT initial. And here's what happens. You see some different curves. This is like mu KBT equal to 1, and I have mu over KBT is a half. But the point is, I apologize for being slightly cut off, that the critical interaction strength, something that's important in those theories is that I assume that KFA was small, okay? And you see the critical interaction strength for getting, at which I get to the right temperature to see BCS, right? This is not extremely small. I mean, you know, it's a third or a half. So my theory is qualitative. It's in this region that you would get to BCS, right? This is the BCS curve, I guess. But you know, I don't so much believe results up here because you know, interaction strength is really quite large, and I assumed it was small. Yeah, Tony.
In your normal state, your calculation of the fermion entropy was based on the assumption that you're above TC, above.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So this is the transition temperature. It's not what happens below. I could also calculate what happens below.
Yeah.
Actually, I did, but I didn't publish it.
That's a very strong reversal, because now the entropy of the Fermi system is going down very rapidly.
Right. I guess there's two regimes. You know, one is the bulk regime, and then there's the regime where, or the mean field regime, and then the other regime is where you get into, you know, the discrete trap issue again. So it depends on how KBT relates to 1 over the density of states at the Fermi surface, right? In terms of calculating the entropy. Actually, I used your paper, so your famous one, BCS. So, but this is not published work, though, but I don't mind mentioning it. So basically, it depends on, you know, what is the entropy of fermions, you know, when you have a BCS around. And it depends on how KBT relates to 1 over the density of states at the Fermi surface, which is, you know, more or less H bar omega up to possible splittings. So that's an important consideration. Yeah.
So you would pick up a T over TF factor in the TF factor.
Well, okay, I mean, I guess that...
I didn't write down the answer. I'm just pointing out there are two different regimes. Yeah.
If you go down to sufficiently low temperatures at the BCS end, if you're well below TC, then it's going to be dominated by the boson light.
Right.
So you may still get some advantage. But the bosonic specific heat of the fermions is going to be very much less, presumably, than the bosonic specific heat of the bosine, because the effective velocity of sound is really.
So you think this is worth calculating, huh? I didn't actually follow up and do it, so maybe I should go do it.
I mean, in that limit, you should restrict the calculation.
Right. Now, you know, it's straightforward. I mean, I just basically didn't write it up. So, okay. Because I thought this was already sort of enough. I mean, you get the transition temperature, but maybe this is an important point I should follow up on. Anyway, okay, so that's the answer to your question, Jason. Then, I mean, out of these, you know, various methods that we thought about, eventually we said, you know, forget sympathetic cooling. This is much better. I mean, maybe I'm short on time, so I should end here. I don't know how. The only thing I'll mention is that there's a slightly improved version of this, which I just, just got accepted. I submitted this paper a month ago or something, and it's what happens if you start with fermions, and then this is for A less than zero, right? And then you go to a system with A greater than zero, and you have fermions plus bosons, in the sense that you have some molecules that don't, you have some atoms that don't pair. I don't mean from an excess of spin states, of one spin state or the other. I mean that you have some atoms that don't pair into molecules just, you know, because of the dynamics of the system somehow. Or, I mean, you come up with lots of reasons. Yeah, I don't think that's a totally clear point. So there are thermodynamic calculations. That would be on this. So the calculation I've seen on that is the one by Jora and Christophe Salomon, and who's maybe Servas is on that, Servas Kokomans. Yeah. and that assumes chemical equilibrium, but I'm not convinced these systems are always in chemical equilibrium. For example, at Gila, the chemical equilibrium prediction is totally different from what they have. So I assume that, suppose that you assume that you have thermal equilibrium, so you consider this adiabatic tuning, but you don't worry about chemical equilibrium, and now you choose some ratio here. Well, on this side, the weight of the entropy is carried by the fermions. So if I can remove them, it's like I'm removing entropy. So if you think of these as atoms and these as molecules, if you can blow away the atoms without blowing away the molecules, and then tune back, you get to an extremely low temperature. And then you can sweep back and forth and use this as kind of a cooling method. So I have another paper where I work this out, and it turns out you can get to low temperatures. And you can start at like, T over TF equal to 0.1, and you get down to 10 to the minus 3 and 3 sweeps or something. I mean, it's pretty easy. So if that actually works, okay, there are people who are blowing away atoms without blowing away molecules and don't seem to have excessive heating. But I don't know about the precise details of this, but that's another adaption of this idea, Jason, to answer a question of how it can even be improved beyond this, because this assumes one sweep, right? Okay. Okay, so thanks for all your questions. That was my first project on kinetic theory, and, you know, maybe I didn't make the best kind of choices about it, so I would love to talk more about it with those of you who are more expert than me. So I won't go through the conclusions, that's obvious. I just want to say that this idea of tuning molecules into their constituent fermions was used in a whole bunch of different experiments. And here's the papers if you want to go look up this work. And thanks a lot. So.
Thank you. And I think we should...
Let Han go, huh?
Yeah. Are there any questions?
Yeah, I have a question about this. Sure. This is the second part that you didn't have much time to talk about.
I didn't talk about it all.
Which is the heat capacity.
Right.
Yeah. Can you? I mean, just give us the bottom line.
Sweat.
Yeah.
The bottom line is sweat. Sweat has a very small heat capacity, but it's a great coolant, right?
What's
sweat? You know, when you sweat. I mean, compared to the body, it has a very small heat capacity, but it cools the body extremely well, huh? Because there are other features in the problem. It's not just two blocks. I have some initial temperatures. I put them together, and I get out a final temperature according to heat capacities. I have blood circulation. I have evaporation. And I actually mentioned sweat because it relates to these experiments, because it evaporates, right?
No, let me rephrase the question.
The problem with sweat is that I feel better. Actually, I don't know whether my temperature is actually low. I feel better. That's all. So never mind.
So the common wisdom is the following. You use bosons.
You know, always the digits and sixes.
Not right. The common wisdom you're going to say doesn't include evaporation. Put evaporation in the problem and see the answer that you get.
So you have Fermi gas, you have bosons, yes?
Yeah.
So when the bosons become very close to zero temperature, removal of the bosons does not generate changes much heat. So that's why the heat capacity of bosons become very small. so it becomes a less effective coolant.
I'll be happy to show you the paper. I proved that that's absolutely the opposite is the result. And another limit to see is that if you have a perfect Bose, an ideal Bose condensate, right? A zero temperature Bose condensate, what is the heat capacity of that condensate? It's zero. Yet it cools quite well. I mean, if I jumped into a big condensate, it would be very uncomfortable, right? I mean, it doesn't do nothing. Huh? So the idea, so that's an extreme limit, to give you an example. Huh? I mean, a bath of liquid helium will definitely freeze somebody, right? That's an extreme example, but you know what I'm saying? It can have very small heat capacity.
Yeah, I mean, I know the conclusion of your paper. I just wanted you to give me a punchline so that...
I thought the sweat was a pretty good punchline.
okay. I
can go into the proof afterwards, Lee, but basically you can prove it thermodynamically and it works out well. Yeah, please, Jason, go ahead.
You have to assume that any non-zero energy bosons, you can be just selectively get real.
No. I just make a much more reasonable kind of... I will show only one picture, Jason, and then I promise I'll stop, okay?
No,
here.
I have to stop Lee. It's not start to stop me.
Oh. it's the usual cooling mechanism. You know, you make a clot somewhere, and this is all standard stuff, right, out of BEC studies. So.